The number of alien species that have invaded the Great Lakes continues to rise. Some people have the impression that biologists can just eradicate them, get rid of them. Most of these invaders are here to stay, and the best we can hope for is a way to control them. That can be an ongoing battle. That's the story behind a new book titled Great Lakes Sea Lamprey, The 70-Year War on a Biological Invader. The book's author is Corey Brent, and he joins us right now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, so shortly after I started covering the environment for the Great Lakes region back in 1998, I was introduced to a sea lamprey on a personal level. I was given a tour of one of these lamprey traps that was on some Wisconsin stream, and the conservation officer asked me, would you be interested in having a lamprey attach itself to your hand? Don't worry, it's not going to, you know, cause blood. It's not going to draw blood. So I let him attach it to the back of my hand, and after a minute or two, he went to remove it, and I was bleeding like crazy. And the really interesting thing about that, I never felt a thing, nothing. So tell us what these sea lampreys look like and why they've had such a devastating effect on Great Lakes fisheries.
Yes. Well, it sounds like you experienced the wrath of the sea lamprey firsthand, no pun intended. But so sea lamprey are kind of like this tube-like fish. They are a fish, and they're invasive in the Great Lakes. We do have native lamprey species. I want to emphasize that.
I saw that, and that was news to me. I read that in the book, and I thought, we have four native lampreys, but this one is bigger. And a lot worse for the system.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head there. This one is bigger, and that's the main issue. These things can get, a sea lamprey can get about the size of my forearm when they're a fully grown parasite. So they have all these weird life stages, kind of like a cicada you would think of on terrestrial setting. So on land, we have cicadas, and they can be a larvae in the dirt, and then they emerge, and they're this flying, chirping insect. Sea lampreys, it's a little bit different. They also have a larval stage where they actually live hidden under the sediment in streams. You'd never know they're there. And at the larval stage, the native lamprey in the Great Lakes and the sea lamprey, they all look pretty similar. But then sea lamprey emerge from the muck and they turn into this large tube-like parasitic fish. Their head looks kind of like a modified drill bit, honestly. It's they have these rows of sharp teeth and they're kind of stained yellow, like coffee stained almost. Then they have this rasping tongue in the center of their throat. They swim kind of like an eel, but they're not eels at all. They're not even related to eels. They're way more primitive than that. They're kind of like living fossils, I guess you could think of them. And they swim up alongside a fish and attach themselves to the side, just like they did to your hand. Only on a fish, they actually end up wearing away scales, breaking away capillaries, and getting a pretty good blood meal, and that's how they feed. So they parasitize, kind of like little vampires of the Great Lakes.
Sometimes that fish dies, sometimes it doesn't.
Exactly, yeah. About 4 out of 5 die. You get that, occasionally you get a fish that survives and then it has this wicked scar on its side.
How did these sea lampreys get into the Great Lakes? Because they're from the Atlantic, right?
Right, yeah. They're actually an Atlantic Ocean species. That's what makes it so weird. Their scientific name is Petromyzon marinus, so you can tell right away they're a marine animal. But they've adapted to a fully freshwater life. And the biggest hypothesis on this of how they came in is through the Welland Canal, perhaps the Erie Canal. We have this long history of building canals to get ships into the heart of North America and the Great Lakes.
Yeah, the Welland Canal is that one that bypasses the Niagara Falls.
Yes, so. Exactly. Yeah, so historically, Niagara Falls, it's like 140 foot high, this thundering falls. No sea lamprey could get over this. It was like a barrier, a natural barrier. And that separates Lake Ontario with Lake Erie. But once you get into Lake Erie, you're connected to the top four Great Lakes. You know, you've got free range of the Great Lakes Basin. So the Welland Canal bypassed Niagara Falls to let ships through. It's kind of like a straight shot right around Niagara Falls, connecting Ontario to Erie, and that's how they think they came in.
So how bad did it get? How much did the Great Lakes fisheries suffer from the invasion of these sea lampreys?
Well, it was actually not, there were no alarm bells rang about these things in the early days. In the 20s, a few sea lamprey popped up in Lake Erie, and they thought they were weird. I'm sure commercial fishing families had seen native lampreys in the past. They just thought this one's weird because it's really big. And sea lampreys kind of kept under the radar. The Great Lakes weren't very healthy in the 20s, 30s, 40s. There was a lot of industrial dumping, pollution, habitat loss. So they didn't really thrive because there wasn't a lot for them to attach and feed on. Lake trout were kind of their main prey item, the native predator in the Great Lakes. And there weren't a lot of them around. So sea lampreys kind of trickled through the shadows of the next couple decades. They didn't really make a big fuss until about the 40s.
And then what happened?
Then it was kind of like a sci-fi horror film. So they started showing up everywhere. A lot of sea lampreys spread up into the upper Great Lakes, so Lake Huron, Lake Michigan, especially in northern Lake Huron and Lake Michigan, where there was a lot of families that fished.
Yeah, we still had commercial fishing at that time. A lot of families relied on that. And I guess it dropped the population, or the catch dropped a lot, right around 1949?
Yeah, 49 is when the big crash of especially lake trout and whitefish. Those were like the bread and butter of the Great Lakes fishery. Everybody met. There was a little dock and a fish shanty in every town. Everyone would come down on, you know, on the weekend and buy fresh fish. That's what people did. But the fishing family started to notice that these fish were looking like Swiss cheese, essentially. They were coming in all mangled and pale. They weren't sellable. They used to sell fish the whole body. So they'd say in the round, you know, we'd be selling fish fresh in the round. These fish looked mangled and diseased, and nobody wanted to buy them. And those are just the fish that were surviving the attack of the sea lamprey.
So you've got this problem. Now it's causing economic damage as well as biological damage. You had to get rid of it, right? So what were the first efforts to get rid of the sea lamprey?
Yeah, the efforts to get rid of sea lamprey. So they did a lot of stuff in the early days, kind of creative things. One of the things they wanted to do is bring in American eels, which are another species sort of native to the East Coast.
They're almost gone.
They're very threatened as well. And eels, again, they're not related to sea lamprey, but they look similar. And eels feed on larval sea lamprey in their native range. So they wanted to bring them in. That didn't work. They all died upon shipment or something. Then they were like, well, we can fence off the entire river with sort of a barrier, some kind of physical fence, and just not let sea lampreys move up into the river. Because like salmon, sea lamprey need to move up into a river to spawn. So they have this vulnerable stage that everybody knew right away, and that's their spawning run, essentially. If we could trap them or stop them, they can't reproduce. So they tried building these fences. They didn't work very well. We all know that rivers in Michigan can be very wild. They can flood. They can send a log down through that just blows out everything, which then you get, you know, thousands of lampreys moving past. So the next thing they did is actually really bizarre. They essentially electrified those fences. They were even, the press called them death fences back in the 50s.
Still trying to keep Asian carp out with those, but go ahead.
Yes, exactly, yeah. It's funny how history, you know, repeats. And so they had these electrified weirs, and they would charge them. It was an alternating current. They would tap these things right into the high lines or run them with a generator. Of course, we all know electricity and water. These things ended up failing all the time. They would short out, and lamprey would move past. So then they started messing with different ways of trapping sea lampreys. And there's a lot of traditional ways to do this. There are like interesting little basket traps that you can put into the river. You can put a trap into your weir that kind of funnels them in, kind of like an oil funnel. They just move right through a small hole into an area and then you net them out. They experimented with all kinds of things, but none of it was really working. There was still a lot of parasitism out in the lake. By the mid-50s, they estimated about 100 million pounds of fish were killed by lampreys annually, which is just an absolutely tremendous amount.
And then we go to the era of lampricides, or poisons that were dumped into stream to kill the young lampreys. How well did that work, and were other fish affected by that?
Well, that's an amazing story. So the next thing, you know, coming out of World War II and into the 50s, this was like an era of better living through chemicals. Pesticide
right.
movement was there. And they started looking at chemicals, but they never wanted to just develop a general poison. And I've dug and dug. I'm not sure why they were so interested in developing a poison that was kind of like a selective toxicant. They only wanted to kill lamprey. They knew that putting just a normal poison in the river would kill everything. And that's what, you know, they were all fisheries biologists at the time. They did not want to kill fish.
Right.
They wanted to kill lamprey. So they started looking into this idea for the first time ever of a selective toxicant for a specific pest organism. They had tinkered around with this type of stuff for mosquitoes in the past and other pests, but never a fish. And it was really hard because you had to put it in water. So they started tinkering, and what they did is it was called the era of the pickle jar biologists, where they would essentially get tons of pickle jars, put a few lamprey in, larval lamprey, little babies. Then they'd put a few bluegills in or some other small fish, a few rainbow trout, and then they would add all these chemicals and see what died first. And that's pretty much it.
Wow.
They did it thousands and thousands of times.
I get, it sounds a little crude, but I guess that's the only way you could do it, right?
Yep.
Now, eventually, better lamprecides, more selective lamprecides came along and started being used. Now we've got these pheromone traps, which are really interesting. And we're not going to go into all of those different ways, but there have been a lot of ways you've reduced the lamprey population way, way down. I say you because you're involved in this effort as well. You concentrated on sea lampreys, but the book covers other invasive species and the changes that have taken place in the fisheries over the decades. Do you think most anglers, sport fishers, or the general public understand how much the fish population and the kinds of fish in the Great Lakes has changed over the last several decades?
Yeah, especially the people that have been in the water or multi-generational fishing families, for sure. They still remember, there are a lot of people around the Great Lakes that still remember the worst of the lamprey. And to those individuals, when you ask about invasive species, they still say lamprey was the number one thing on their mind. But most people see these incredible changes. A lot of them are a lot quicker within, you know, lamprey have been under control, the sea lamprey has been under control for over 60 years. But other things like the zebra mussel and the quagga mussel, major ecosystem rearrangers. I mean, these things have cleared up the water of the Great Lakes. That's probably the number one thing I hear about is people used to remember they couldn't see their nets 5 feet below the surface of the water. Now they can see them 60 feet down.
I can't tell you how many people have told me, oh, the lakes are so much better, so much cleaner. I'm like, no, well, that clean's nice, but it what that means is the base of the food web is gone because of these mussels, and they're shocked to hear this. And I'm thinking, this has been around for 20 years. How come we don't know about this?
Yes.
All right, back to the lamprey. It costs something like $20 million a year to keep the sea lamprey population under control. The population has been limited for decades, like you said. Why do we need to spend so much money on the sea lamprey?
Well, it's sort of like we're prisoners of our own success. We've controlled sea lampreys. And when I say we, mainly the sea lamprey control is a program put forth by the Great Lakes Fishery Commission here in Ann Arbor. And they've worked for about 60 years to keep these things reduced about 90% from their historic population. They'd love to eradicate them, but it already costs $20 million annually to keep them at this level. So the Fishery Commission in Ann Arbor works hard to get this done. And we've gotten glimpses in the past of what will happen if lamprey control is sort of like relaxed. And what'll happen is that sea lampreys make a very quick comeback. And they start to feed on any large-bodied fish they can find. They prefer lake trout, but they're not that choosy. People don't understand that these would be attacking Chinook salmon, sturgeon, which are threatened, any big species that we like to fish for, or any species that essentially makes up the top of the food web in the Great Lakes is at risk. And so they're sea lampreys, just like zebra mussels, are these major ecosystem disruptors. If we let up, they make a comeback.
Corey Brandt is a researcher at the U.S. Geological Survey Great Lakes Science Center. His book is Great Lakes Sea Lamprey, the 70-Year War on a Biological Invader. It's put out by the University of Michigan Press. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thank you, Lester. That was great.